I don't know.
Hey, guys. Welcome to the show.
Back to it.
Is it true that today's Friday?
Oh, good.
Yeah, that means I have to work tomorrow, too. You know, the wife was saying to me that she is tired of me working 16-hour days. And I told her, yeah, me too. I know you guys think, but the show's only 2 hours long, Scott Horton. Yeah, but I'm pretty much working till from 8 to midnight every night. Got a lot of reading to do. That's why I'm so smart. I'm actually not smart. I just read a lot. That's why I know so much. That's why I'm good on everything. Yeah. Tomorrow, big day. Lots and lots of work to do. Tomorrow, including I got to record an interview for the Sunday show. I do work a lot, don't I? I think the wife kind of has a point there. Yeah, well, anyway. And for peanuts, you have no idea. All right, well, it's a supply and demand thing, you know. All right, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at the Liberty Radio Network from noon to 2 every weekday, Monday through Friday here, LRN.FM, LibertyRadioNetwork.com. You know, LRN guys, I think the trend nowadays is to go ahead and go with the long URL. Like it used to be AmCon Mag, and now it's just TheAmericanConservative.com for the American Conservative magazine. I think that LibertyRadioNetwork.com is a better URL because then it says what it is right there in the URL. LRN.FM? If you already know what it is, then you know what it is, but otherwise it's just some weird letters. LibertyRadioNetwork.com, of course, forwards you to LRN.FM, but, you know, oh, Liberty, I like that, and then, you know, radio, oh, I like listening to things, and network, well, that makes sense. I guess that means it's more than one show, and it distributes to places, and .com, why, that's a URL there. Okay, LibertyRadioNetwork.com, yeah. See? That's not that hard to type. Does it take much longer than LRN.FM, actually, if you know your home row? I do some hunting and pecking, too, I admit. All right. So, yeah, LibertyRadioNetwork.com. That's the Liberty Radio Network. Well, I better write the date on today's show notes here, the 26th. Hey, guess what? Our old friend John Pfeffer is going to be back on the show. It's been way too long since we had John Pfeffer on the show. He's got a good one about Iran and North Korea. Some of the parallels and the other things. Yeah, I think they have the URL. They have a long URL. It just forwards on there. Well, I bet I ought to try Liberty Radio Network. Oops. .com. Yeah, see? Forwards to LRN.FM. LibertyRadioNetwork.com. Yeah. Perpendiculars, parallels and perpendiculars in the Iran and North Korea nuclear issues. All right. Cool. Yeah, boy, I'm going to have to read those details later. That's complicated. Okay. Yeah, so lots of bad news to talk about. Wars everywhere. All of them America's fault. All of them America's fault. And by America, of course, I mean the state. The evil men and women who control the empire from Washington, D.C. Everything wrong in the world is because of them. The bastards. So, yeah. Got lots of that to talk about. First I want to tell you, stop by my website, scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there, more than 3,700 of them now, going back to 2003. I really should just stick with more than 3,500 until we get up to 4,000. More than 3,500 of them now, going back to 2003, scotthorton.org. And join up the chat room, man. Hey, chat room guys, how's it going? Number 6 is talking to me already. Good to see you there, number 6. The rest of you guys, join up the chat room. Hang out with number 6. And M. Strong. And JDA2000. They will all be very happy to see you join up. It's scotthorton.org/chat. It's an IRC free node chat room, #ScottHortonShow. So whichever of those is most convenient for you. ScottHorton.org/chat. And, hell, you know what? I never mentioned this, but I really should. ScottHorton.org/donate. Why, that's the donate page. That's where you can find out how to give me money. You know, assuming that you value what you hear on the show. And if you donate more than $100, then I send you a commodity disc in the mail from commoditydiscs.com. And, yeah, they're really cool. In fact, just yesterday someone tweeted me, "Hey, my commodity disc arrived and it's great, man. It's just like you said and it sure is shiny and I love it." And yeah, that's true. I will send you a commodity disc. It's a 1 ounce silver piece. It doesn't have a face value on it because, hey, it's a floating price in the market compared to US dollars, right? So what it is it's got a QR code on the back. You scan it with your phone and it tells you how much it's worth right now, this instant, or that instant. Mm-hmm. And I've the future of money on the face of the earth, if you ask me. Is that not the most beautiful thing you ever heard of? An ounce of silver, and it talks to you and tells you how much it's worth from moment to moment. That's pretty badass, man. So, yeah, stop by scotthorton.org/donate, or I forgot if we changed it now, scotthorton.org/support. And I take bitcoins, too. Say you have a mess of bitcoins, and you don't want them anymore. You want to give them away to somebody. Hey, you send them to me. And by the way, I had a backup loss, and my old Bitcoin address from back when no longer exists. So if you've been sending me Bitcoins to that old address, you better quit it. I got a new one. Yeah, I lost 2 entire Bitcoins there, about $600 worth of bits. These things happen. It's that app data folder, man. It was supposed to back up, and it didn't, and then it was taken for granted that it had, and it hadn't. But anyway, I got a new Bitcoin address. If you want to send me some Bitcoins, send me some fractions of some Bitcoins. And yes, if you send me more than $100 worth of Bitcoins, then I'll still send you a commodity disc. It doesn't have to be US dollars. Send me Bitcoins more than $100 worth, or $100 or more worth, and yeah, you'll get a commodity disc for that too. So there you go. That's how to help support the show that y'all love so much. Okay, cool. And, oh, follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Some of them hate me. Some of them just love me. Over there on Twitter. When I ain't complaining in this microphone, I'm complaining into my Twitter. Quit Facebook a year ago. Feel real great about that. But, yeah, Twitter, I might as well get a Twitter chip implanted in my brain at this point. I am so completely wrapped up in that damn thing. I can't help it. It's great. I love it. It's that instant gratification thing, you know? I say, "I hate this thing," and then people retweet it. And I go, "Yay! They retweeted my hatred. It makes me feel so happy." That's twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. And then retweet me. For God's sake, retweet me. Especially when I tweet out things like today's show, John Pfeffer. Retweet that. So that your tweeps can see my tweets. All right. I guess now I should get to work. We begin today with Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com. Leave the Houthis alone. Why, Justin asks, are we on the same side as the Saudis and Al-Qaeda in Yemen? Well, because that's what Israel wants, man, and because that's what Saudi Arabia wants. That's the answer. Same reason we're on the side of Al-Qaeda in Syria still. And, yeah, I'm already out of time for this segment. Boy, I do go on, don't I? All right, well, when we get back, we will have more Yemen news. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group.
I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. Hey, y'all, run out and get a copy of Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013-14 by Chris Braswell. The book takes a gonzo look at daily life in America, columns, informational letters, and other marketplace vigilance, a look at drug abuse culture and its marketing, and a series of contemplative and metaphysical essays. Get Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013-14 in paperback, hardcover, and digital formats at fusepowder.com.
All right there. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I need to read this chat room more carefully before I respond to things. Anyway. Hey, I'm Scott. Join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Hey, everybody. Good to see you in there. Okay, so now, I kind of wasted that whole dang segment. Let me get to the war in Yemen. There's a war going on in Yemen. What happened was, as Justin Raimondo explains in this article, there really is no such country as Yemen. It's really at least three different countries stuck together. And the Houthis, they're the Shiites from the north. Everyone claims that they're backed by Iran, but no one's ever really proven it. Although, I guess it would make sense for the Iranians to help them some. But anyway, they have driven America's sock puppet dictatorship out of power in Sana'a. I know what you're saying. But Scott Horton, Hillary Clinton said that it was a model election. Yeah, it was. If this was the Soviet Union, there was one man on the ballot. And yes, of course, she went ahead and hailed it as democracy in action. They pushed out their former sock puppet, Saleh, and replaced him with their new sock puppet, Hadi. And as Raimondo explains in here, and Jeremy Scahill had done a great job of explaining this before, all the aid that America gave to Saleh to use against Al-Qaeda, he ended up using against his other enemies, because what do you expect them to do? And of course, because as part of American policy, it just backfired. And in attacking the Houthis, he just made them more powerful. And so now, a couple of few months ago, the Houthis came down and sacked Sana'a, the capital city, and took it over. And it's been a little bit of a slow motion takeover, but day before yesterday, the Hadi regime fled by boat. And the Saudis declared war and started bombing the hell out of the place. And they're putting together a coalition. I guess probably it'll be the Pakistanis doing their fighting for them. Saudis don't work. They've got oil money. They hire foreigners to do their work for them. And as Eric Margulies was explaining on the show yesterday, the Saudis don't trust an army to exist. They have their internal so-called National Guard to protect their power. Domestically, but when it comes to fighting external wars, that's what Americans are for, aka Operation Desert Storm, or I guess EG, Operation Desert Storm there. Anyway, they're claiming that they have this gigantic, coalition, but it's just a George Bushian coalition of the willing here. They have the Libyans on paper. They have the Somalis on paper as members of their coalition. Oh, really? Somalia is going to invade Yemen and kick the Houthis out of Sana'a, huh? When they can't even defeat Al-Shabaab, which of course only exists because America intervened against Al-Shabaab and made them more and more and more and more powerful. Just like they always do. Whether they're fighting against someone or fighting for them, they always make them more powerful, whoever they are. I don't know. It's a strange thing the way that works. In different places, anyway.
But so Raimondo is asking the question, and Pat Buchanan is asking the same question here too in his article, The Enemy of My Enemy. Why in the hell is America backing the Mujahideen if the Houthis in Yemen are the only force capable of fighting Al-Qaeda in Yemen? Then what the hell are we doing backing the Saudis and their other allies against the Houthis? It's treason is what it is. After all, Al-Qaeda in Yemen has tried to attack the United States a couple of times. And a couple of bogus attempts, really. I mean, not very scary ones, but they have tried. And they are loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. But anyway, hey, if Israel hates Iran, then I guess that's what really matters, right? If Saudi Arabia hates Iran, that's what really matters, not who killed 3,000 Americans. It's the foreign powers who rule Washington, D.C., not the American people. And so, America's, of course, coordinating the whole war. And fighting against those who would fight Al-Qaeda. And I don't know what else to tell you. U.S. confirms involvement in coordinating Saudi attack on Yemen. Officials confirm U.S. to provide logistical support for the war, writes Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. White House has confirmed today they are in contact with the Saudi government, coordinating with them on the ongoing attack and pending invasion of Yemen. The scope of U.S. involvement in the war is still being fleshed out, but for now, Obama has authorized the Pentagon to provide logistical and intelligence support to the Saudis, according to National Security Council officials. General Lloyd Austin says U.S. military forces will also take steps to ensure that the Bab al-Mandeb Strait off the Yemeni coast remains open. The strait is a key choke point for oil shipments to Europe. That's the gate of the Red Sea there. Saudi warplanes began carrying out airstrikes on Yemen on Wednesday, and they have some 150,000 ground troops massed at the border, anticipating an invasion at some point in the future. Really? 150,000 ground troops? I don't buy that. Maybe that's what they say. That couldn't possibly be true. I don't think they have 150,000 soldiers. Certainly not with guns. As Margulies explained on the show yesterday, they don't trust them. Saudis don't trust an army to build up. So, 25 civilians killed as Saudi warplanes attack Yemeni capital, including a very small child was killed, at least one. Again, Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. The airstrikes against Sana'a centered on a military airbase in the north of the capital and a missile base in the south, but bombings also strayed into nearby civilian neighborhoods. The death toll is expected to rise as local rescue teams are still pulling people from the rubble. The Saudi government announced last night that they were attacking Yemen with an eye on reinstalling President Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi, who resigned in January. The airstrikes are just the first of what will likely be a very ugly war. And as he says here, an unknown number of Egyptian troops are pledged to intervene as well. And then I love this. White House continues to insist Yemen a model for counterterrorism. Maybe they really do know what they're doing over there, huh? All right. Back with more bad news right after this. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions.
you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Man, I hate Fox News so much. That's why I watch it all day. I guess I hate myself. I'm punishing myself. No, I mean, I need to know what they're telling the people so that I can rage against it. Oh, my God, all day long. All day long. The crucifixion of Bo Bergdahl. Pardon me, lying a-holes. But as CNN, in this case, your betters, are reporting, quote, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl left his unit in eastern Afghanistan in July 2009, intending to walk to the nearest U.S. military outpost to report wrongdoing, believing he could not trust his own commanders to deal with his concerns. An Army report says. Reports Barbara Starr, Pentagon spokeswoman, a.k.a. CNN reporter lady. Bergdahl was planning to report what he believed to be problems with, quote, order and discipline in his unit. A senior defense official tells CNN. A second official says Bergdahl, quote, had concerns about leadership issues at his base. Treason! He was captured by the Taliban. He was tortured for years. He tried to escape more than a dozen times. But if you ask Fox News, he ought to be nailed to a tree. He ought to be crucified like the Islamic State. Bo Bergdahl, let me tell you, the worst thing that Bo Bergdahl ever did in his life was join the American government. It's military. This information is part of the report presented to General Mark Milley, who this week decided to charge Bergdahl with desertion and misbehavior before the enemy. This information outlines what could be a key part of Bergdahl's defense. Yeah, you think so? What Bergdahl's concerns were and whether they are relevant to the case of desertion the Army is trying to make will be a matter for military authorities to decide. I can't tell you if his concerns were valid, but in my mind, they were, the official said. This was a kid who had leadership concerns on his mind. He wasn't fed up. He wasn't planning to desert. All these rumors about, oh, he was going to go walk to China. Oh, he was going to go join up the Taliban to fight and kill his comrades. Lies. Oh, he's guilty of treason for being kidnapped by the Talibs. Lies. CNN reported last year a British filmmaker working in Afghanistan in 2009 filmed Bergdahl and other members of his platoon in Afghanistan showing alleged lax discipline, including the soldiers not wearing mandatory protective gear. One sergeant was demoted and three others reassigned. At that time, a U.S. official who had been briefed on the initial Army fact-finding investigation conducted in the months after Bergdahl disappeared told CNN that some of Bergdahl's teammates said he had expressed boredom and thought his unit was too passive and should have been kicking down doors. Yeah, I don't know about that. From what I understand, he was upset about the killing of civilians and the complete and total lack of accountability. How the hell are we supposed to win hearts and minds
when our guys are killing their civilians and laughing about it to their faces, mocking them. So he went to walk to another American military base to try to find someone of a higher rank in a separate chain of command who could help to address his concerns. Go ahead, shout it out. You got it memorized. You know the words. The surge is working. The surge is working. David Petraeus is the greatest general ever. The counterinsurgency doctrine that he rewrote is brilliant, genius, better than Mao Zedong. Gotta fight a people's war over there, don't you know? Well, David Petraeus knows. We're gonna change their entire society. That's a real quote from John Nagle, co-author of The Coin Doctrine from the Center for a New American Security. We're going to change their entire society. We're going to give them a government in a box. We're going to clear, hold, and build a brand new Afghanistan for the people of Afghanistan. And when we run over their toddlers with our trucks, we're going to laugh right in the dead kid's father's face and mock him and ridicule him. And tell him he's a damned dog. Because, you know, America, the shining city on the hill. Yeah, and any soldier who decides he's had enough of this and he wants to go to another base where he can find another American officer who hopefully is of sound mind to try to help him, to reassign him, to try to instill some authority over the people who are doing wrong at his base. Oh no, that's treason. How dare Obama trade some tired old Taliban officials from Guantanamo Bay who never committed a war crime against an American at all in exchange for this heroic American prisoner of war? And now, why are they charging him with desertion? Politics. They admit in their own damned report, they admit that all he was trying to do was the right thing. He wasn't going over to the enemy. He didn't tear off his insignia and renounce the United States of America. But, hey, Fox News, I'll tell you what we should do. We should get a giant cross and we should nail him to it. And then, I don't know, how about light it on fire, too? The Islamic State of Fox News. How about we give you guys a machete and you go ahead and do the right thing and cut his head off? Oh, whoops, this is supposed to be on mute. Wow. You know, Fox News, they're like the government. They just can't say a thing that's true, no matter what. No matter what. A thing that's true. Okay, get on there and say the opposite of that. This man who was kidnapped by the Taliban, who was tortured for years, who tried to escape more than a dozen times. And they would have you hate him. They would have you hate him and call him a traitor. And wish to see him buried under the brig. You know, the same one where they got Chelsea Manning. Because they hate truth. They hate virtue. They hate honesty. They hate America over there at Fox News. They're doing the best that they can to destroy this country. And it's working. And anyway, I gotta say, I think that Bo Bergdahl really made a bad decision in joining the U.S. Army. What did he think he was gonna do? Change Afghanistan's entire society. He was going to clear, hold, and build their hearts and minds. And give them a government in a box so they could be a Westphalian, Western European democratic nation state. He could have been working in the private sector helping people this whole time, you know? But you should be forgiven.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, man. Hey, if you want to know more about the Bird Doll case and you missed the show yesterday, go back, check out my archives at scotthorton.org/interviews. I interviewed Matthew Ho all about it. He knows the score. All right. So, the Iraq War 3 here. Shiite militias quit to Crete, citing U.S. involvement. Complain U.S. trying to steal their glory. Yeah, lots of glory there in the Bada Brigade and the Mahdi Army. Three major Shiite militias have announced they're withdrawing from the Iraq-Iran offensive against Tikrit, citing recent U.S. involvement in the campaign. A fourth militia said they will remain involved in the offensive, but also threatened to attack members of the U.S.-led coalition while fighting ISIS, suggesting they might be using anti-aircraft weaponry against U.S. warplanes. Some of the militias are complaining that they had the battle for Tikrit almost won on their own, and that the U.S. is coming in at the last minute to try to hog all the glory. That claim doesn't seem to coincide with Iraqi comments on the offensive, which seemed entirely stalled in the face of ISIS opposition. And indeed, they insisted it could not continue without air support. Even with air support, ISIS has shown surprising resilience in the battle for Tikrit, a city of some size, but not much strategic value, and has kept the Shiite-led offensive against the city mostly stuck on the outskirts, leaving them wreaking havoc on the Sunni villages near Tikrit, but sparing the city itself. Yeah, amazing. I think pretty much everybody expected for Tikrit to fall pretty quick. They sent 30,000 men. About 10,000 of them from what's left of the Iraqi army. I guess that is what's left of the Iraqi army that George Bush built with all your money. But they sent the Bada Brigade, and apparently the Mahdi Army was involved as well. Asaib al-Haq and whatever other Iranian-backed Shiite militias. They say even Iraqi Hezbollah. And they all went to sack Tikrit, and they can't? Jesus, man. What the hell is going on over there? All the original stories said that ISIS had more or less fled. They left some fighters in the center of the city, and they had set up booby traps everywhere. They had snipers and IEDs in place. So it wasn't going to be that easy to conquer the place. But American air power, as Nancy Youssef explained on the show a couple of weeks ago, American air power is preventing ISIS from sending reinforcements. Whoever was left in Tikrit was all they had. And the Bada Brigade, backed and led and organized by the Iranian Quds Force, can't even take Tikrit on what's now, what, their third or fourth attempted invasion of this city in the last 9 months? I guess their third one. That's amazing to me. I admit that I'm surprised. They say Soleimani is gone for for now. I don't know if that's really true. But geez, it's been almost a month. 20,000-30,000 men sent to take to Crete, and they can't take it from the Islamic State. This is amounting, I think, to a huge victory for ISIS, and a huge and ridiculously embarrassing defeat for Qassem Soleimani and the Iranians and their Iraqi sock puppets. Yeah, it's really something else. And by the way, whenever you hear the Americans complaining about Iranian influence in Iraq, I don't know, laugh in their face. It was Iraq War II that gave Baghdad to Iran's sock puppets. I know I'm a broken record on this, but then again, there are some people only hearing the show for the first time. Iraq used to be a minority-ruled Sunni dictatorship under Saddam Hussein. And when America invaded, they put the supermajority, 60% majority Shiites in power there. The other 20% are the Kurds up in the north. And the Kurds had their alliance with the Shiites, at least back then, and somewhat still. But it's not just that we got rid of Saddam for them. It's that all of you and your family members who repeated that, well, we can't leave now or things will get worse. We've got to stay the course. We've got to defeat the terrorists and win to create a democracy for the Iraqi people. Well, all those words, all those fancy words, all they meant was our soldiers have to all die in order to kick 5 million Sunnis out of the capital city and make it an entirely Shiite city. Well, like 90%. Except a few neighborhoods in the southwest. That's what all that stay the course was. Oh, we can't leave now or things will get worse. That meant we have to fight a civil war on behalf of Iran. And now they want to cry about Iranian influence in Iraq. Well, we'll help bomb Tikrit, but not as long as the Iranians are there. As this McClatchy story, it's not Prothero, it's somebody else. Mark Seibel in McClatchy quotes these guys complaining that Soleimani was behind. Well, it says here, Soleimani's role made the Tikrit operation an especially sensitive one for the United States. The U.S. blames Soleimani for hundreds of U.S. casualties during the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Even right there, they give away the whole game, don't they? Hundreds, not thousands. America lost almost 5,000 men fighting that war against the Sunni insurgency for Soleimani, for Iran, for Muqtada al-Sadr and Hakim Abdulaziz al-Hakim and the Supreme Islamic Council and their Badr Brigade killers. Only after they finished winning the war for the Iranians did the actually least anti- the least pro-Iranian of the Shiite militias, the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr, did they turn on the Americans and start bombing the Green Zone and letting them know that you can't stay. Thanks for giving us the capital city. Now don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. And it was Sadr that insisted as part of the Iraqi National Alliance that Nouri al-Maliki refused George Bush's requests for permanent bases and immunity for American soldiers. That's another one of these right-wing talking points. Oh, if only we had stayed. Yeah, well, it was George Bush who signed on the dotted line when his former sock puppet, he thought Maliki, told him, get the hell out of my country, pig. And Bush signed it. And you can go back and check the interviews of Patrick Coburn all through 2008 on this show. In the spring of 2008... Yeah, America's pushing for 56 permanent bases in the summer of 2008. Well, they're trying to settle for 20. In the fall of 2008, well, they're saying, can we please have even one base? Come on, man, please. And then by the end of November, there's George Bush signing a status of forces agreement that says all American soldiers will be out of the country by the end of 2011. No immunity for you. Oh, and then all the right-wingers want to complain that Obama lived up to the deal that their hero, George W. Bush, signed after being defeated by the people who he helped win the war in Iraq. And now they want to cry about, oh, well, we don't want to fight for Iran. We're just fighting for Iran. Or are they? I don't know, man. Look at this piece in Moon of Alabama today. You got to wonder, dude. You have to wonder. U.S. role in Iraq endangers the anti-Islamic State fight. Some 4,000 Iraqi army troops and some 25,000 Shia militia have surrounded Tikrit in Iraq. There are few civilians left in the city, but some 1,000. That's it. 1,000 Islamic State fighters have barricaded themselves inside, and digging them out would be a very bloody and costly affair. Up to recent days, the U.S. was not involved in the Tikrit campaign. The Iranian advisors who accompany the militia... Well, I'm skipping ahead. I need to skip ahead because I'm almost out of time here. Some elements in the Iraqi army trained by the U.S. have insisted on U.S. airstrikes on Tikrit. The Shiite militias and their advisors have insisted these are unnecessary. Under U.S. pressure, the Iraqi Prime Minister Abadi sided with the U.S.-trained military staff and allegedly ordered the Iranian General Soleimani to leave. Now the U.S. bombs the city, but the bigger Tikrit campaign is falling apart. And then, well, you'll just have to go look. It's the Moon of Alabama blog. Music's playing. Gotta go. But point is, America keeps bombing the Shiite militias and saying, oops, we were trying to hit the Islamic State, but accidentally we keep bombing the guys that we're fighting for. America serving the Ayatollah and Zawahiri at the same damn time. Why not? Ibrahim, I meant. Well, same difference, really. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Man, I have got to get with somebody to make me a minute-long bumper thing to replace The Onion. I am so sick of The Onion. Jesus Christ, they haven't made me laugh in I don't know how long. Years, maybe. What the hell is the point of The Onion? It's not funny. It's not satire. It's not anything. It's just stupid. And I'm pretty sure this is unanimous. Chatroom guys, have you laughed at a thing that you heard on the Onion Radio News on this show in the last year? Me either. I just cut a minute of Bill Hicks or something. I don't know. I can't really edit stuff together very well, but I'm just going to have to make up some kind of minute-long intro to the show that plays before the bumper music and then beg Ian to kill The Onion. I am so sick of The effing Onion. They're about as funny as Fox News. Actually, not as funny as Fox News. At least Fox News has the whole absurdity thing going for them. The Onion has absolutely nothing going for them whatsoever anymore. And if a single one of those is funny, we've heard it 100 times, and it's not funny anymore. But 99.999% of those damn things don't even make me smile at all. At all. And I know I'm a bit more hateful than the average idiot, but still, man. I'm tired of stupid Onion. You know, it would be hilarious if someone went to the Onion headquarters with an AK-47 and shot them all and then replaced them with people who are funny. Now hiring funny people to write for The Onion. God's sake. That could be an Onion story. Guy breaks into Onion headquarters, shoots everyone, the entire world breaks out in applause. Finally, a terrorist attack we can all get behind. No more failed attempts at humor for you! Sorry, I'm just so far beyond sick of it, I can't stand it. All right, Jeff Stein in Newsweek, Spy versus Spy, Espionage, and the U.S.-Israel Rift. Hey, what the hell happened to my story here? Oh, I've reached my limit of 5 articles a month at Newsweek, have I?
All right, I'll just go and put it in another browser then, you sea suckers at Newsweek, who all suck except for Jeff Stein, who I love. If more evidence was needed to show that the relationship between Benjamin Netanyahu and Barack Obama has morphed from tragedy to farce, it came last Monday with the revelation that Israel had spied on the nuclear talks between the United States and Iran. The White House discovered the operation, according to the blockbuster account by Adam Entwistle in the Wall Street Journal, when U.S. intelligence agencies spying on Israel intercepted communications among Israeli officials that carry details the U.S. believe could have come only from access to the confidential talks, officials briefed on the matter said. Talk about spy versus spy. The old Mad Magazine trope featuring two pointy-nosed, masked cartoon creatures. The National Security Agency eavesdropping on Israeli officials, as usual, according to the revelations of Edward Snowden, overheard them discussing intelligence their own spies had gathered by spying on the U.S. By spying on U.S. officials talking about the Iran negotiations. This is a whole new level of gamesmanship between the two bickering allies, quote-unquote allies, he meant to say. It's one thing for the U.S. and Israel to spy on each other. It's another thing for Israel to steal secrets and then play them back to U.S. legislators to undermine U.S. diplomacy, an unnamed senior U.S. official told the Journal. Officials in Jerusalem issued emphatic denials, as they did last year when Newsweek reported him, Jeff Stein did a three-part series last year, on Israeli espionage against the U.S., saying that, quote, Israel does not spy on the United States, period, exclamation mark. Yeah, that's also completely and thoroughly debunked in The Intercept by Glenn Greenwald yesterday as well. The liar said on Israeli radio. Of course, Israel does spy on the U.S. and vice versa. In the age of cyber war, electronic spying runs on autopilot, with state-of-the-art Pac-Mans zooming around the internet, gobbling up anything with the right keyword. Anybody with an antenna or keyboard spies on whoever is seen as the remotest threat, including friends. Or, as the Journal put it, while U.S. officials may not be direct targets, Israeli intelligence agencies sweep up communications between U.S. officials and parties targeted by the Israelis, including Iran. Yeah, well, just read James Bamford about how the Israelis wrote the software that runs the NSA. The Israelis own the U.S. government lock, stock, and barrel. And how did the Israelis intercept conversations between officials in Tehran and Washington? In another comedic dimension to this latest spy flap, it turns out that, quote, U.S. intelligence agencies helped the Israelis build a system to listen in on high-level Iranian communications, the Journal reported. In part, it's an old story. Israel's clandestine operations to steal U.S. scientific, technical, industrial, and financial secrets are so commonplace here that officials in the Pentagon and FBI periodically verge into open revolt. Last year, U.S. intelligence officials trooped up to Capitol Hill to tell U.S. lawmakers considering visa waivers for Israelis that Jerusalem spying here had, quote, crossed red lines. One congressional staffer who attended the behind-closed-door briefings called the information, quote, very sobering, alarming, even terrifying. Another staffer called it damaging, quote, we used to call the Israelis on the carpet once a year to tell them to cut it out when a particular stunt was just too outrageous, says a former top FBI counterintelligence official. They'd make all the right noises and then go right back at it through another door. But since Israel is such an important strategic ally of the U.S., it was a sin that could not be named. The standing order has always just been to suck it up. Until this week, the accusations by the unnamed Obama administration officials marked a new frontier in calling out the Israelis, or at least Netanyahu's right-wing administration. Netanyahu had crossed some sort of red line again when, according to the Journal, his man in Washington began quietly sharing Israeli intelligence about the U.S. negotiating position with members of Congress, hoping to shore up support for its rejection of any deal with the Iranians short of a total nuclear capitulation on their part. But what seems to have pushed Obama administration officials over the edge was that Ambassador Ron Dermer, a former Republican operative who holds U.S. dual U.S.-Israeli citizenship, which how in the hell is that allowed in this country? Ron Dermer, a former Republican operative who holds dual U.S.-Israeli citizenship, was wildly exaggerating what the U.S. position was, according to the journal, making it sound like the White House had given away the store to the Iranians in a desperate effort to ink a deal. Republican Representative Devin Nunes of California, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, indicated he had gotten a different view on Iran from sources outside the administration. Quote, "As good as our intelligence community is, a lot of times we don't even know what the Iranians are up to," he told CNN. "So we were shocked at the disclosures that have come forward of the size and scope of the Iranian program, even in the most recent years." Yeah, in other words, Devin Nunes is a sock puppet of a foreign power sitting in your American Congress. One former U.S. intelligence operative with long firsthand familiarity with Israeli operations called the revelation, quote, "appalling but not surprising, especially under Netanyahu, whose governing coalition depends on the support of far-right Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox parties with a stake in the West Bank settlements." Quote, "The fact that there's such manipulation of our institutions by a so-called ally must be exposed." Oh, I love this. Are you digging this? This is a former CIA officer, former U.S. intelligence operative here. "The fact that there is such manipulation of our institutions by a so-called ally must be exposed. And the useful idiots in the U.S. government who toe the Likud line will someday be looked back upon as men and women who sacrificed the U.S. national interest for a foreign ideology, Likud right-wing Zionism," the operative said. Got that right. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. Yeah, JDA's pointing out in the chat room that, you know, the law is that you can't give foreign aid to a rogue nuclear state, and the pretension that Israel has an ambiguous nuclear capability is over because of our friend, the heroic Grant F. Smith, whose Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy sued and got declassified a 1987 document explaining that Israel has hydrogen bombs. The kind that could kill all of Dallas, all of Houston, all of New York City in just one shot. The kind of bomb that make Nagasaki look like nothing. In fact, I know I'm beating a dead horse here. As Daniel Ellsberg likes to say, for an H-bomb, a Nagasaki-type implosion, fusion, plutonium bomb, fission, plutonium bomb, is the blasting cap for a hydrogen fusion bomb. So you gotta make it hotter than the sun in order for fusion to be possible. So they use a Nagasaki bomb to make it possible for them to fuse hydrogen atoms together and get the real bang. We go from kilotons straight to megatons worth of TNT. Explosive power there. And yeah, it's a crime. That's, crime. It's forbidden by American law. Whatever. There's no such thing as law. You live in a corrupt, evil empire. The most corrupt country in the history of the world. And they can do whatever they want. And they can kill whoever they want. That's the law.
Give me a break. And yeah, you know, I have to say, man, as much as I hate Barack Obama, no other president that we will ever have will ever hate Israel as much as he does. And that really breaks my heart. Did you see Jeb Bush pitch James Baker under the bus the other day? I mean, this is just unbelievable to me. James Baker is one of the most powerful men in world history. He's the Sith Lord. He's the power behind the throne. He's the lawyer for Exxon, man. He's the boss of Houston, Texas. And when he criticized Israel the other day, and Bill Kristol demanded that Jeb Bush denounce him, Jeb Bush denounced him. Jeb Bush denounced James Baker III for daring to criticize Likud party policy when it comes to the Palestinian occupied territories. Are you kidding me? It's almost like a foreign country controls the government of our country. It's as if Capitol Hill is Israeli occupied territory itself. And Jeb Bush, what a weakling. What a pathetic specimen. You know, I've been on the record for years now. I've been on the record for years now saying that it is guaranteed 99.9999999% chance that Jeb Bush is going to be the next dictator of the American empire after Barack Obama. Who's going to stop him? It's obviously going to be him. And people might remember Clinton years as better than Bush years, but those are Bill Clinton years, not Hillary Clinton years. Everybody hates Hillary Clinton. She reminds everybody of their boss that they hate. She's a terrible person in every way. Now, Bill Clinton is too, but he can pretend that he's not. She can't. Remember when they tried to train her how to laugh, and then she went out going, ah. Huh? Okay, never mind the thing about laughing. There is no Republican who could stop Jeb. There's no Democrat who can stop Jeb. It's going to be Jeb. But then again, wow, I don't know. Maybe I overestimated this guy. Maybe he is such a pathetic weasel and weakling that, he won't be able to get that nomination after all. I don't know. I mean, who are they going to give it to? Marco Rubio? Of course it's going to be Jeb, but, I mean, to me, this is just incredible. Just incredible he won't stick up for James Baker. And, you know, I guess the Bush boys never did like Baker, right? I know George W. Bush wouldn't listen to him. I'm not certain why I believe this anecdote, but I do. It's Max Blumenthal's father, Sidney Blumenthal, admittedly a Hillary Clinton confidant. But he had this story in Salon.com. Salon.com actually used to publish things that were worthwhile back, say, a decade ago. And he had a series in there. I really highly recommend this to you guys, too, man. Go and search Sidney Blumenthal at Salon.com and read all about the splits between the neoconservatives and everybody else in the Republican Party back during the Bush Jr. years. There's a lot of really interesting stuff in there. And one of them has it where when George Bush gave his 48-hour speech, "We're invading Iraq, even if you do flee to Cairo, we're still invading Iraq," speech, that James Baker turned to his buddy on the couch and said, "Oh, I told him not to do that." And of course, we know about Bush, basically crying over his father's alter ego, Brent Scowcroft, writing the article, "Don't Attack Saddam," in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, that was a message straight from the father to the son and did nothing but piss Junior off and make him twice as determined to ruin everything back then. So maybe Jeb is as much of a petulant little child as Junior, and he's just mad at Baker saying or doing anything. But it seems like the more plausible explanation is
that he knows that the most powerful wasp in America is nothing compared to the power of Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party from Israel in the capital city of our country. And so, if Netanyahu and his Israeli fifth column in America want Jeb to denounce James Baker, blam. Denounced. Done. If that ain't a measure of what the hell is going on around here, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, that is just absolutely incredible to me. Absolutely incredible. I mean, credible. I don't mean uncredible. I just mean incredible, if you take my meaning. It's really something else. And they're doing everything they can to destroy this nuclear deal. I think the only thing we have going for us at this point is that they've overplayed their hand. There's a story today. There's a story today about how the, and also in Newsweek, about how the entire Congressional Black Caucus is anti-Israel now because of what Netanyahu did to Obama. Even though they're very kind of Old Testament-y, they're over it now. Thank God for that. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome back. All right, our guest today is our old friend John Pfeffer from Foreign Policy in Focus, Institute for Policy Studies. And then here he is at the Loeb blog. I lost the damn tab here. The article is about Iran and North Korea and the talks. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, John?
Good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Very happy to have you back here. Here it is. I found it. Iran, North Korea, and the Congress that says no. And, yeah, I hate Congress, too. They suck. I mean, I guess it'd be better to have them and no president to carry out their will. If that was my choice, I'd settle. But anyway, in this case, you're talking about various presidents. First of all, Bill Clinton back in the 90s and now Obama trying to come to some sort of nuclear compromise in the cases of Korea and Iran, North Korea and Iran, and how the Congress just will do everything that they can to screw these things up. So, you know me, I love talking about this agreed framework and how it came together and how it all fell apart, because I think it's such an instructive story. So could you please tell us about the agreed framework deal that Bill Clinton made with the North Koreans back in 1994, the context and what the deal was?
Sure. Well, folks might remember, if they're old enough, I guess, that we almost went to war with North Korea in 1994. North Korea withdrew from the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty in the spring of that year, and the conflict escalated as the United States tried to find a variety of different methods of persuading North Korea to return to the NPT, the United States, along with other members of the international community. And it got to a point where it really looked as if the Clinton administration was very seriously considering a military attack on North Korea in order to take out its nuclear capability or its burgeoning nuclear capability. And then right before any conflict broke out, former President Jimmy Carter, more or less on his own initiative, the Clinton administration was not enthusiastic about his trip, decided to go to North Korea, sit down with the North Korean leader at that time, Kim Il-sung, and out of that meeting came the kind of germ of a compromise. And that compromise is basically...
I'm sorry, hold on right there, John. I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir, but your phone has kind of a bad microphone on it. But I can hear you loud and clear. So if you could just maybe back up a little bit, hold the phone a little bit further away from your mouth. It's the wind of your breath is messing with the microphone there.
Okay. How is this?
That sounds much better. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry about that. So.
No problem at all. I'm sorry to interrupt.
So Jimmy managed to get this compromise, and the compromise was relatively simple. It acknowledged the fact that North Korea was desperate for energy and wanted energy and saw nuclear energy as a kind of solution to its problem of electricity. So instead of a nuclear program, or at least a program that would that could easily produce a nuclear weapon, there was a substitute. And this is the kind of the basis of the agreed framework. The United States agreed to provide North Korea with two light water nuclear reactors. In other words, reactors that did not produce the kind of uranium or plutonium that could be easily turned into a plutonium device, as well as heavy fuel oil that could be used as well in the interim period between the time that it took the international community to actually build these light water nuclear reactors. And in exchange, North Korea agreed to freeze its nuclear weapon development program. Now, the Clinton administration basically brought that to Congress, and Congress was not all that happy over the summer of 1994. It was very skeptical about negotiating with North Korea in the first place, and much of the negotiations that were taking place were not particularly transparent, as these negotiations tend to be. I mean, it's just diplomats who are trying to hammer something out in a closed environment. Now, the problem was, of course, that the congressional complexion, shall we say, changed in 1994. Both houses of Congress became Republican, and the Republicans had even greater skepticism about this entire process. And when they kind of looked at this agreed framework, they were not happy with it. And the Clinton administration said, well, look, I know you're not happy that we're giving this country, an adversary of ours, these nuclear reactors, but you have to understand that this is a compromise, and it's better than they're developing a nuclear weapon. And they said this rather quietly, you probably don't have to worry too much about this because North Korea will probably not be around by the time these reactors are actually built. So that was the agreed framework.
Donald Rumsfeld's company got the contract to build those light water reactors, and they got the money whether they ever deliver the reactors or not, right?
That's correct. And now the lead for the construction, although, you know, there were American companies involved, the lead player was South Korea. South Korea was the one that they were the people that brought in the personnel to build it, try to build it. And they provided much of the resources. The lion's share of the money came from South Korea, not the United States. The U.S. Congress did, however, appropriate some money for the construction of the reactors as well as the money for the heavy fuel oil. Another component of the deal was that both sides would work toward economic and political normalization. In other words, eventually, as part of this rapprochement, the United States would recognize North Korea diplomatically and lift, eventually, economic sanctions. But that never happened, I mean, in part because Congress was very skeptical about the entire arrangement. Congress made it more difficult even to supply the heavy fuel oil. There was a great deal of mistrust on both sides. Eventually, North Korea made a tactical decision to pursue a different path for the bomb secretly, uranium enrichment. And the whole deal eventually fell apart by 2002.
So all right, now hold it right there, because there's some things I want to go over there. First of all, as far as congressional opposition, what's the big deal? I mean, I'm a libertarian. I'm not for anybody getting any kind of welfare. But if we're talking about America paying a little bit of welfare and fuel oil and subsidizing some light water reactors to keep the North Koreans inside the NPT, What the hell could be wrong with that? Even if you're a Republican and you hate things that are true and reasonable.
Uh-huh. Well, I think animating much of the Republican opposition was a pretty simple postulate. In other words, and it was phrased later by Dick Cheney, and that is, you don't negotiate evil with evil, you defeat evil. And so their operating assumption was, we shouldn't be negotiating with North Korea at all, much less giving them anything. We shouldn't be giving them heavy fuel oil. We shouldn't be giving them nuclear reactors. We should be seeking regime change. And so the idea of coming up with any kind of agreement with this country that would, in essence, extend the life expectancy of the regime in Pyongyang was anathema to them.
So, in other words, they bought the... I guess the CIA or whoever's estimate that North Korea will fall pretty soon, and then, but just based on that prediction of a possible future, they decided they wouldn't want to go the extra mile to keep them in the NPT.
Basically. And now, to be fair, North Korea didn't look like it was in particularly good shape, you know, circa 1994, 1995.
Right.
Shortly after the agreed framework was negotiated, Kim Il-sung died. And he'd been the only leader that North Korea had had since 1945. And the second thing was that the country was experiencing a severe food crisis and economic crisis more generally.
Right.
So the expectations that North Korea would collapse were quite popular at the time, either as a result of the leadership crisis, a result of the economic crisis, or simply because, you know, when people were looking at Eastern Europe and they saw the example of all these communist countries there collapsing,
right.
They just expect North Korea would follow suit.
Right. Man, these segments go so fast. I'm sorry I got to stop you here, John. We'll be right back, everybody, with the great John Pfeffer, writing this time at loblog.com. Jim Loeb's great blog, Iran, North Korea, and the Congress that says no. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, talking with John Pfeffer, writing at Low Blog here. Iran, North Korea, and the Congress that says no. So we're talking about the deal that Bill Clinton struck with the North Koreans back in 1994, the agreed framework. We'll give you fuel oil and money and light water reactors if you'll promise, which can't be used to make nuclear weapons, to produce weapons-grade plutonium, if you promise to leave off your Soviet-era reactors that do, in fact, produce weapons-grade plutonium. And how the deal fell apart, and this is one thing I wanted to get a point of clarification. I know we've been over this, but now I forget. You just said, and you say in the article here, that the North Koreans went ahead and embarked on a second track to a bomb, and that was a secret uranium enrichment program. And now I know that the Bush administration, when they broke the agreed framework deal, they claimed that the North Koreans had broke it and that had broken it, and that they had admitted to it at a dinner party or a cocktail party or something. The North Korean ambassador, apropos of nothing, said, oh, yeah, by the way, we're in violation of the NPT and we're secretly enriching uranium for a bomb. And they said, oh, yeah, well, we're going to put all these sanctions on you and we're going to create the Proliferation Security Initiative and we're going to renounce the deal and claim that you broke it. And yet I never knew of a reason to believe that that was true. Seren Cioni from the Plowshares Fund says, oh, trust me, I know the guy that he said it to, and he really said it. And I know that that North Korea has a uranium enrichment program now, but what reason do you have to believe that that's actually correct, that they had a secret uranium enrichment program back in 2002, John?
Mm-hmm. Well, apparently, and, you know, I haven't verified this with my own eyes. I simply have gone by the statements of experts who have examined the evidence, that the Clinton administration had evidence as early as 1998 that there was a secret enrichment program going on in North Korea. In other words, prior even to the admission by the North Korean diplomat.
Oh, really?
And comment. Now, how developed was this program? That's hard to say. Probably wasn't that well developed. It was probably, you know, something the North Koreans were using as an insurance policy. And it was certainly possible when the Bush administration came into office that they could have negotiated on this issue as well.
Right.
To maintain the agreed framework and perhaps even to make it more comprehensive.
Right. Yeah, that's an important point, that even if they were in violation of the deal, it didn't mean that we had to just go ahead and break the deal and shove it in their face and force them out of the nonproliferation treaty, which is basically what they did, was just beat them over the head with sanctions until they finally renounced the treaty and started making nukes. And as we know, they've done 3 nuclear tests, and I don't know about the third one, but the first two supposedly were plutonium attempted implosion bombs, not uranium. And a uranium nuke, a simple gun type nuke, is much easier to set off. They could have had a very successful nuclear test, it seems like, if they had enough weapons grade uranium to build a gun type nuke, but they keep trying to implode plutonium bombs and they keep fizzling out.
Yeah, I think the reason probably is because of the amount of plutonium they have. You know, it requires a certain amount to test, and if you use it all up, then you would, frankly, have no deterrent left in any shape, size, or form. So my guess is that they just don't have sufficient amounts of enriched uranium to test. Whereas ever since they started up their plutonium program again, and remember, there wasn't an option about midway through the Bush administration to effectively roll back that plutonium program, but unfortunately that too fell victim to politics, and North Korea started up again. So my guess is that they have enough plutonium to warrant the use of.
And yeah, and that's an important point, right, that it was Christopher Hill, right, convinced Bush to ignore Cheney and let him go over there and make a new deal in, what, 2007 or 2006?
Mm-hmm.
And then how did that one get screwed up again?
Well, that's complicated. And perhaps we want to kind of segue. I don't know how much time we have.
Oh, yeah. No, go ahead. We can talk about Iran instead. Yeah. Anyway, the point being that the North Koreans have nukes now because of the complete and total failures of American diplomacy here, and especially because of congressional obstruction, I think is the point you're getting to.
That's correct. And, you know, we have this kind of deja vu happening again, in the sense that we have an administration that's committed to making some kind of a deal with Iran, a strong deal, not a concessionary deal. And Congress has put up any number of roadblocks to that. And I should emphasize, it's not just the Republicans here. I mean, there are plenty of people on the other side of the aisle that are not happy with the deal with Iran, in part because they've essentially taken the same position as Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, and that is they want to have as strong a negotiating position as possible, in other words, one that provides no compromises, in order to effectively force the Iranians into a bad situation. Now, then there are people further to the right of that, people like John Bolton, for instance, who wrote recently an op-ed saying we should just go ahead and bomb Iran, which is not terribly difficult, different from positions that Bolton and others took back in the 1990s with respect to North Korea.
Well, in 2002, was that their plan, that we're going to force them out of the NPT, and once they start making nukes, then we're going to attack them? But then they just got too bogged down in Iraq to do so, and so now they've got nukes, and now we can never attack them? Is that it?
Well, they certainly had contingency plans for an attack on North Korea. I think there are a couple of reasons that they didn't. Number one, as you point out, we were certainly overwhelmed with other issues at the moment, and the prospect of not only waging a war in Afghanistan, but preparing for a war in Iraq, made it very difficult for the Pentagon to even contemplate an attack on North Korea as well. And the second is that once the Pentagon did some serious research on what the consequences would be of an attack on North Korea, they got cold feet. The consequences were not so much for the United States, although obviously we did have at that point, about 35,000 American troops in South Korea. And the consequences were largely for South Korea. And the Pentagon made it clear that if we were to attack North Korea, the bulk of the casualties and the consequences would fall on South Korea, mm-hmm. our ally. So there were a number of reasons why we didn't go ahead with it.
Right. Well, so in other words, they didn't really have their policy very well thought out, it doesn't sound like. And I guess if we're
Which
talking
is-
about... And that's the Bush administration. If we're talking about Congress, forget it. They don't have a plan. All they know is what they don't want.
Right. And you know, the level of sophistication when it comes to an attack plan to North Korea is roughly comparable to the level of sophistication in the attack plan on Iran. I mean, it sounds good, perhaps, to a certain constituency which would like to punish Iran for what Iran has done to the United States, or because they don't like Islam, or they are concerned about the so-called Shiite crescent in the Middle East. I mean, any number of reasons, suggest to certain people that bombing Iran is the right idea. But once you actually look at the difficulties of that, number one, identifying where the nuclear facilities are located and how difficult it would be to take them out. But number two, the kind of consequences it would have for the Middle East once Iran retaliates would be devastating. It would be devastating throughout the region. It would be devastating not only for U.S. policy and U.S. interests, but certainly the interests of our allies in the region. So it doesn't take very long for either the Pentagon or for any government organ to understand that bombing Iran strategy is ridiculous. It has no military value in the sense of actually eliminating Iran's nuclear capability, and it would have tremendous side effects that would harm U.S. interests for decades to come.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, the best that the war party can come up with, the best that I've read from them along these lines would have been not Bolton, but Joshua Moravchik in the Washington Post said, well, and you know, if we bomb them and that makes them decide that now they want to finally start making nukes, well, then we'll just have to keep bombing them. We'll just have to go back and keep bombing them and bombing them and bombing them. And then that'll prevent them from ever making nukes.
Mm-hmm.
That's their idea.
Yeah, it's not really. It doesn't qualify as an idea, really. It qualifies as just a knee-jerk reaction based on failed policies of the past. And you know, the bottom line is the negotiations that are taking place today in Switzerland in order to wrap up some kind of a blueprint for negotiations by the end of this month. In many ways, are far more sophisticated than the negotiations that took place around the agreed framework.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 1990s, we had only a dim understanding of what North Korea's nuclear capabilities were. And we had only a dim understanding of how North Korea might break out of any kind of agreement. But today, we have a great deal more sophistication. And as a result of the kind of verification methods that the IAEA have been pursuing with respect to Iran for many years, we have a great deal of understanding of where Iran is right now in its program and how best to retard any kind of efforts to create a bomb. And when people talk about a breakout time of 6 months or a year, I mean, to be honest, that's not exactly correct. The breakout time, functionally speaking, which would be much greater than that in any kind of agreement that's being considered. People talk more in terms of 5 or 6 years that Iran would have to in order to create any kind of feasible nuclear device. So this is a much better agreement than what we were considering back in the 1990s with respect to North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Well. Yeah, I mean, certainly when they say breakout, they just mean the amount of weapons-grade material that they would have. But now, Gordon Prather likes to emphasize how when they did the Trinity test, that was for the Nagasaki bomb. They knew the Hiroshima bomb would work, a simple gun-type nuke. It's difficult to deliver, and it would be much bigger, but they could make a pretty simple gun-type uranium nuke, but then what? They have one nuke. Big deal. They sure couldn't use it on anyone. And then, obviously, for them to make any kind of sophisticated, miniaturized implosion plutonium bomb or something like that, as you're saying, would take years. It would take a huge amount of infrastructure. Gordon Prather says, yeah, let me know as soon as the Iranians have built their own replica of the Lawrence Livermore or Sandia National Laboratories, because that's what it takes to make a real implosion bomb, the kind that you could fit on the end of a missile and launch toward, I don't know, Riyadh or something.
Mm-hmm. So we are, you know, we have about, you know, only a few days before we will see some kind of an agreement. And people are saying that it's likely we'll get something at the end of this weekend. But the debate really continues in Congress, where Congress is pursuing two strategies. One is an attempt to kind of oversee any kind of agreement requiring the president to sign off that Iran is still abiding by the agreement, or in some cases, Iran is not committing any terrorism acts, another effort. And then the other effort is to increase the threat of sanctions. In other words, to ensure that there are another round of sanctions at ready, even before the diplomats have managed to come up with a final agreement, all of which sends, you know, the wrong signal, to say the least, to the Iranian negotiators. The same kind of signal, for instance, that Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, sent when he corralled 46 other senators to send a letter to the Iranian leadership saying, hey, you know, a future Congress, a future president can basically tear up this agreement and say it's worthless. In other words, Congress is basically saying to the Iranians, you can try all you want to get this agreement, but ultimately we're the ones who make the decisions, not only about the longevity of this agreement, but also about the sanctions and how long they're going to remain in place.
Yeah. Now, one thing is that they seem now to, the Israelis have kind of pushed it too far and turned enough Democrats against them that they don't have a veto-proof majority on these sanctions anymore. It doesn't look like. Newsweek is reporting this morning that, for example, the Congressional Black Caucus is now 100% in the president's camp on this because of the offense that they've taken to Netanyahu's speech and also his racist remarks on Election Day Eve or whatever over there in Israel. So that's good news. But I wonder, you know, as far as it goes, the threats and the letter and all the Republican hype, have you seen much of an effect in terms or do you know of if there's been much of an effect in Iran and in Iranian politics against the deal? Is this really strengthening the hand of the hardliners? Are they calling Rouhani a fool for trying to deal with us?
So far, no. I mean, but there are, you know, it's not like the hardliners are just sitting around twiddling their thumbs.
Right.
They are pushing for instance, you know, Ali Khamenei, the Ayatollah, the supreme leader, is sick. I mean, he has cancer, I believe, and who knows how long he's going to last. And so the battle that's, you know, shaping up in Iran today is who's going to be the successor. Are we going to have someone like, for instance, Rafsanjani, who's, you know, more or less a reformer, or are we going to have somebody who's a little bit more in the Khamenei camp, much more of a hardliner? And that ultimately will determine the future of Iran, not this nuclear agreement. The nuclear agreement, in some sense, is just a tool that one side or the other uses in this larger battle over the future of Iran. But at the moment, at least going into the negotiations, or as we come to the end of this particular round of negotiations, the reformers seem to be in some control, at least, of these details. I mean, the Iranians are trying to get the strongest possible deal that they can get so that the reformers, when they bring it back to you know, Tehran, people don't laugh at them and say, well, you just gave away everything to the Americans. So they have to demonstrate that they, you know, compromised fairly and strongly. But other than that, I think they're in reasonably good shape.
Yeah. All right. Well, I've already kept you way over time here, but thank you so much for your time and coming back on the show, John.
It's a pleasure, and good luck with the show.
Thank you. Always good to talk to you, sir. That's the great John Pfeffer, everybody. He's from the Institute for Policy Studies, Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org. And this one is at loblog.com. Iran, North Korea, and the Congress that says no.